So, good afternoon, everybody. How's the conference going so far? Good stuff? Was there internet to access today? Okay, that's good. So I'm Michael Wash. I'm a technical evangelist on the Windows Azure team. And for the past 9 to 10 months, I've been working on Windows Azure virtual machines and virtual networks. So what we're going to talk about today is just some good overview of how you can actually start using Windows Azure Virtual Machines to start building out scenarios, start migrating apps out to the cloud. So before I get started too far, how many of you are actively using Windows Azure today? How many of you have seen any talks on Windows Azure Virtual Machines so far? Oh, good. I like that. So I don't have to go into too much of the getting started. So what I'm going to talk about today is just getting started, because just to make sure that everyone's up to speed on how to create virtual machines and what they're used for, all that good stuff. Going to talk about some application migration strategies. We're going to talk about imaging virtual machines, deploying enterprise apps. So I'll talk a little bit about Active Directory integration and how you main join VMs. And finally, we'll talk about connecting cloud services. So getting started, what really envisioning most people will do to migrate applications out to the cloud is you'll really have two options. You'll have the ability to upload VMs out to VHDs out to the cloud, or you can actually start with cloud-first provisioning. And what that really means is, instead of uploading terabytes of VHDs, you can literally just start by creating virtual machines up in the cloud and then move your applications out there. There's three entry points for creating a VM in the cloud. The first one is a Windows Azure Management Portal, which allows you to walk through, select images, and get some basic configuration before you create the VM. A second one is we have two different command line interfaces. One of them is Windows Azure PowerShell commandlets, and we also have a Linux and Mac cross-platform command line tools written in Node. And the third option is, if you're a developer, we have everything you can do in the management portal, at least involving automation of VMs and scripting, we actually expose to a REST interface with the Source Management API. So once you have selected your entry point to creating a virtual machine, you then basically select the image type that you are going to provision. Whether this is going to be Windows Server 2008 or 2012 or one of the Linux distros. You then select the instance size, and we take a copy of the image that you selected, copy it to your blob storage account, and boot the VM off of it. The second scenario is bring your own server slash VHD. There's a couple of use cases for this. The first one is if you have existing VHDs in your private cloud that you want to upload and provision and run in our data centers. So it literally can be upload the VHD, configure it to boot, and it works. Can be. The second use case is sysprepped images. So if you already have the golden image in your corporate enterprise and it's completely patched, configured, everything you want it to do, you can actually take that existing VHD, the image, and upload it as an image and use it as an image you can provision VM from in the cloud as well. So the only real caveat here is VHD must be a fixed disk. And we have a tool that we ship with the Azure 1.7 SDK that will convert dynamic disk to fixed disk on upload. I'll cover a couple other things too. But the scenario usually goes, we take the existing VHD, we upload it to blob storage, and from there, depending on whether it's a disk or an image, we create a VM off of it. So let's go ahead and just, for those of you that haven't seen the portal creation experience yet, just flip over there and create a VM real quick. So for those of you who haven't seen it yet, this is the new management portal for Windows Azure. And I'm just going to quickly walk through and provision a VM. So I'm going to choose the gallery option and select one of the platform images. And I think I'll pick Ubuntu for this. And with Linux VMs, you can give it a username along with the password. You can select your image size. At this point, you can configure SSH using a certificate too. And at this point, you can do one of two things. You can either create a standalone virtual machine, which basically means whenever it provisions, this virtual machine will have a public IP address and no other connectivity with other VMs. Or you can select connect to an existing virtual machine. And what this basically says is, I want this to be on the same network as other virtual machines running in the cloud. So if you look in the drop-down here, I have four VMs running, IS 1, 2, 3, and a SQL VM. If I select any one of these, it's going to put it in the same cloud service container as those VMs, so they'll basically be on the same network. Okay, I can select the storage account I want the VHD to go in, and when I click the checkbox, it'll actually create that virtual machine. And whenever that VM boots up, it will be on the same network as the other four, and it could be part of the same application. So let's talk a little bit about application migration. So there's a couple of different migration approaches. The first one, like we already discussed, is building the VM in the cloud. The biggest benefit here is it lowers your upload time and dependency risk, because you're not uploading terabytes of OS data, just whatever your application is and your application data. The dependency risk is lowered because, you know, the Hyper-V up in the cloud is not exactly the same capabilities as Hyper-V on-prem. For instance, if you have a dependency on multiple NICs, you can only have a single NIC up in the cloud. This does require you to upload your application installation data, so obviously. The second migration approach is actually migrating the virtual machine itself, which is the benefit of this is you actually know your complicated application works on a VHD. You've already spent the time to install it, configure it, make sure all the registry changes are there, the patches, etc. So it's in a known working state. It does require you to actually upload the VHD to do that, though. So what I talked about whenever we were walking through creating the virtual machine, how adding the VMs to the same network by connecting to an existing VM, this is basically the essence of how you can migrate a multi-VM application. So whenever you have an application that is more than just a single VHD, you have a web farm, for instance, you basically look at the architecture of Azure as using a cloud service, which is just an entity that contains other items like VMs, as a networking boundary. So whenever I added that Ubuntu server to the other machines, they can now communicate directly with each other. So let's go ahead and walk through actually creating a web farm, just so you can kind of really understand the key differentiators of how to get these guys talking on the same network. So I'm not going to do the portal this time. What I want to show now is how we can actually create a full-blown web form just using scripting. So the first thing, how many of you ever are familiar with PowerShell at all? A few? Hey, that's a really good crowd. I like this. How many of you use Windows Azure PowerShell commandlets? All right. So now you'll all have known this by now. So to get started with the Windows Azure PowerShell commandlets, after you've downloaded them off the Windows Azure site, the first command you want to run is get Azure publish settings files. And what all this does is actually pops up our browser and takes you to the right place to download your file. And of course, it wants me to sign in again, because it already forgot my login. Once you log in, it should prompt me to download my publish settings files. So I can download those to my folder. I already have them, so I'll just go ahead and overwrite them. And once that file is downloaded, you can then do import Azure Publish Settings Files. Select those Publish Settings Files and hit F5, or if you're at the regular console, hit Enter. Oops. And that will actually import all your subscription settings. So now if I want to see what all subscriptions I have set, I can say just get Azure subscription. And this will tell me all of the ones I have configured, because PowerShell commandlets can work with multiple subscriptions at a time. So it's not limited to just working with one. You can actually switch context as you go. So I'm going to go ahead and use... Actually, I'll use snippet so I don't worry too bad. So I'm going to go ahead and just select my Microsoft subscription. And I'm also telling it to use this storage account, which is the current storage account. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to provision two web servers and a SQL server. So I've already set up a couple of variables here. Actually, let me unzoom it so everyone can see that. There There we go. So I have two variables set up, an IS image and a SQL image, that I just need to pick the appropriate image. And to do that, I will run the get Azure VM image commandlet. And these are the same image names that you saw in the gallery view going through the portal. So same information, just got through a different resource. So for the IS servers, I'm going to go ahead and select 2012. And for the SQL server, I'll select our SQL eval. Now the next step is to actually configure the VMs. So what I'm doing here is there's three commandlets in use. The first one is new Azure VM config. This basically creates a configuration object that represents a virtual machine that I basically am just setting some properties on it. I'm setting all the configuration I need for the virtual machine, and then I'll pass it to another commandlet later that'll actually take that configuration and go provision it. So I'm specifying the machine name, which actually should be VM1. Specifying instance size, the image name, and add Azure endpoint is actually configuring the load balancer. And I'm passing in the settings so it'll actually be in a load balance configuration. So that's one virtual machine. Here's virtual machine number two. It's essentially the same thing, except it's IS VM2 instead of VM1. And finally, I want to add my SQL server. Now, the SQL server is slightly different. What I'm doing here is I'm actually provisioning two additional data disks during creation. And the reason I'm doing that is SQL server usually performs much better if you split the OS disk or split the data disk off of the OS disk. So I have one disk for data and one disk for logs. Another thing that's really important is by default, our OS disk has caching writes enabled. So whenever you're provisioning a SQL server, you always want to at least provision a data disk and move your data off to it. Or you can actually change the caching on your C drive if you want to as well. So now that I've created the configuration for these three VMs, I call the new Azure VM commandlet to actually create it. And new Azure VM takes an array of VMs, so the three VMs I just created or configured, and it takes the data center name and the source name. So I'll go ahead and hit F5, and we can all just wait about 20 minutes for those to provision. I already have them created. But. So while those are provisioning, we'll switch to another farm that's magically already ready. So I have pretty much the same configuration. I have IS VM1, IS VM2, and SQL VM1. It's just in a different cloud service. So now that they've actually been provisioned initially, what are the next steps to configure them? So we'll start with SQL Server. So I'll go ahead and RDP into this guy. Okay, and first thing you should note is go into computer management and disk management. Notice that we do have our two data disks that we allocated, 100 gigs each. Each data disk can be up to a terabyte. So I need to initialize each of these and then format them. Oops. So I'll put the data drive on F. And I'll put the logs on G. As soon as my mouse comes back. Oops. So I'll make a simple volume on G drive as well. And while that one's formatting, I need to go off and create a directory structure so I can tell SQL where to provision its databases at. So on F drive, I'll just create a folder called data. And as soon as the G drive pops up, we'll pop up a directory for logs and backup. And next thing you need to do is actually configure SQL Server itself to use the new data disks. So you can go to database settings, and at the very bottom, the default location should go to your new data disks. So now any backup or any new database I create will automatically use these directories. Okay, so now SQL Server is configured to use our data disk that we just provisioned. So the next step is, since we're actually deploying a database, we assume there's a database file somewhere. So how do you actually get your data up into the cloud? So the easiest way, honestly, is probably just use your storage account. One of the things I've done is I've uploaded a database into Windows Azure Storage. And I have multiple copies of Cloud Explorer running. And Cloud Explorer is just a tool that you can download that's free. There's plenty of other ones. And what I can do is I can go ahead and just download my famous database, AdventureWorks, off to the G drive. I'll just stick it in the backups folder. Get pretty good throughput. So once the database is there, I can actually just quickly restore it. Screen resolution is killing me here. Can't click that button. Okay, there it goes. There's only a pixel button to click, so it's hard. Okay, so our database is restored. Now, final thing I need to do is configure a user account so the web application I'm going to restore can access it. I already have created that, so I'm just going to add him to the database. Okay, and since this is infrastructure service, we've had to configure the data disk, we've had to configure the actual OS, configure the database itself, we had to do quite a bit of work. The last thing we do need to configure is a firewall, because by default, nothing is going to be able to get to our SQL Server. So I can go in, add a new rule, just add it for port 1433, which is what SQL is on. All right, so we should, at least the database part should be configured. So the next step is we need to configure the rest of our web form. So whenever I created the VMs using the PowerShell commandlets, they're already configured for load balancing. So if I look at the endpoint here, you can see down at the bottom it's ISVM1 and ISVM2 listening on port 80. So just to make sure everything is working, I can look at that public endpoint. And you can see I'm on IS8, the home page. So now I can actually log in and deploy our apps. So just like the database, I'll use Cloud Explorer to actually download the application. So I have a real simple MVC app called Azure Store. Just go ahead and get rid of the default files. Now I did cheat and actually installed IS before you guys got here, otherwise we'd have to wait 20 minutes for me to go through add role. But if you notice, you look at the connection string, you'll notice here, maybe barely if you can't see them in, that I am just pointing directly to SQL VM1. I'm not doing anything fancy. It's just pointing directly to the server, not going through load balancers or anything complicated. Okay, so let me do the same thing on ISVM2. So, and typically, you probably wouldn't use this as your main file deployment method. What you'd probably end up doing is something similar to web deploy, where you can have content synchronization between VMs. But just as a kickstart, this works pretty well. So now we should have the application on both VMs with connectivity back to our SQL server. Still good to Windows 8, and there. So we now have a fully functional, very basic sample application. Now, what's really interesting about this is, you know, why didn't I make this in PaaS? Well, the really beautiful thing about VMs is I can use full-text search in SQL Server. That's, you know, there's a lot of applications out there that have dependencies that just SQL Azure or Windows Azure SQL Database don't have yet. So the ability to drag in whatever dependency your application has and not be blocked from whatever limitations a current platform has is really incredible. So that's basically how you can quickly provision a web farm. Not too bad. I mean, we spun up 3 big servers in 10 minutes. Anyone have any questions over that? It's all pretty straightforward. Okay, so a couple of other tips on virtual machine migration. If you do decide to actually, oh, go ahead. What's that? So for RDP, so by default, whenever we generate VMs, sorry, the question was, how do we access RDP? By default, whenever you generate a VM, we'll have an endpoint open for RDP, and it'll listen on a pretty much a random open port, and you can configure that to forward back to 3389, so you can RDP into individual machines. If you really wanted it locked down, where you wouldn't have any access to RDP, you could essentially make a VPN, a site-to-site virtual network, and remove all your RDP endpoints from the public and only access it internally. So however you wanted to do that. And you can actually use PowerShell commandlets to add and remove them as needed, too, so you don't have to have it on all the time. Question? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear very well. If you have a really simple application, you could put the SQL Server and the web server all on the same machine. It's really however you want to architect it. Right. So you'd still put them in the same cloud service because the cloud service is what gives them the direct network connectivity in the name resolution. Right. Really, the only definition of web farm is just more than one web server. The definition of a web farm in this case is really that you have more than one web server. So, yeah, load balanced. So it'd be the exact same configuration, except you wouldn't have configured load balancer. So if you do decide to go down the path, oh, one more question, go ahead. So the question, is it possible to add more disk space? So there's you can add additional data disks to your SQL Server. You can't currently resize an existing VHD, at least easily. So if you add those 200 gig databases, you'd have to add another data disk. But each an extra large instance of virtual machine can hold up to 16 data disks, and each one of those can be up to a terabyte. And you can dynamically add them too. You don't have to shut them down or anything first. Yes, it does require reboot, but you can change the instance size. Okay, so if you start down the path of actually migrating a virtual machine, just know that VMs in Windows Azure currently only support VHD file format. So if you're on Server 2012 and you create a VM, it'll by default probably create it in VHDX. You'll have to create that back to VHD before you do an upload. We do provide a tool called CS Upload that allows you to upload those VHDs. It does a couple of really nice things for you. First is it does support resume of failed transfers. So when you're uploading really large files, 70, 80 gigabyte, you definitely want it to be able to resume if it fails. Second thing it does is it does convert images from dynamic format to a fixed disk. And the third thing it does is it actually calculates how many empty bytes are on your VHD first, so it makes sure not to transmit them. So it's actually really efficient. One last thing before you upload your OS disk is make sure you enable some type of remote access, because if there's no way to get to it, it's just kind of pointless. So the general flow of how you would migrate an existing VM in, say, a private cloud environment is, say you've started with a VM that 8 gigs of RAM, 4 cores, listens on a website. It's your typical single VM line of business app. It probably has SQL Express on it or something like that. Has the typical architecture CD and an E drive. First thing you'd do is UCS upload to upload the VHDs to Windows Azure Storage. From there, whenever you're piecing the VM together, if you're using a portal, you kind of have to do this one step at a time. If you're using the scripting commandlets, you can actually do it all in one shot. But you would set the OS disk to be the app OS VHD. You would then configure the data disks. And note, you would have to adjust your application for the drive letters. Windows Azure VMs automatically reserve the D drive. What the D drive in a VM points to is actual local physical disk on the server in the data center. So it should be considered temporary, because anything you put in there, if we get server sealed, you won't get it back. So use it for very temporary stuff, tempdb, caching, that kind of stuff. Anyways, so adjust your app to use E or F instead of the D drive, and add your endpoints for the load balancer. Fairly straightforward. So let me show a real quick example of how you can actually use CS Upload and attach a disk. So the first thing we're going to do, I don't have a disk yet, I don't think. Let me see. Oh, so I do have a disk. So I already have a data disk. Does anyone know how to provision VHDs in Windows? Do you know you could do that? Just go in Disk Manager and create one? Anyways. So I already have a 51 gig disk, or 51 meg, sorry. I'm going to upload 51 gigs right now. And I'll go ahead and mount it just to show you that I've put my PowerPoint slide on it. So not real impressive, but it will show. But see, now I have to go unmount it. So here's my 49 meg drive. I'll go ahead and detach it again. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you how you can use CS Upload to actually upload that VHD up to the cloud. So I have a real simple batch file here that uses CS Upload, add disk, and it literally takes the path to my VHD and the target location in my blob storage count where I want it to go. Pretty straightforward. The only thing that's really a little tricky is setting up your connection in the first place. You have to know your subscription ID and your certificate thumbprint. But once you get that in place, it's straightforward. So you can see it already exists. No. Hold on. I'll give it a new name so we can upload it. Okay. So you can see it's processing blocks, it's detecting the empty blocks, data blocks in local files, so it's not going to transmit all 50 megs, which isn't that big a deal. So it should already be there. You can see in my storage count, it's already there. Nice thing of what this does is actually registers it as a disk in Windows Azure too, so you don't have to go make the mapping. So from there, I should be able to go back to, say, ISVM1, and doesn't detect it yet, so hit refresh. And I can attach disk, and you can see my data disk. I forgot to change the disk name. So it should actually attach it to the VHD or to the VM. I should be able to go into log in via RDP and actually see the disk as it's attached. Not there yet. It does sometimes take it. Okay, see, it's still, you can see the little squiggly lines at the bottom pulsating, telling you that it's still trying to attach your 50 meg disk. So eventually that will complete and we can log in and see how we transfer the PowerPoint file. Let's see, I do want to see it pop up though. Oh, there it goes. See, it's already there. So my new volume E, 27 megs free out of 47, and we've now successfully transferred PowerPoint. Not too bad. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about imaging. So how many of you image VMs on-prem or in the cloud today? So the general idea is that you start with a base virtual machine. You boot up Server 2008, Server 2012, whatever. You customize it. This could be installing your application, just like, you know, we copied the Azure Store application. It could be adding registry keys, hotfixes, whatever you want to start all new virtual machines off with, so that every time you provision a VM, you don't have to go through all this work of configuring it. Once it's customized, you generalize it, and you generalize a VM using a tool on Windows called Sysprep. That basically removes SIDs and computer names and all the stuff that makes it very unique and makes it generic. Once it's generalized, you run the capture feature, which is a button in the portal that basically takes that virtual machine, the generalized piece of it, and saves it off into your image library. From there, you can basically, every VM that you boot up using that image starts off with your own all the stuff that you customized on that VM. So let's walk through the basics of how to do custom images, and then I can show you how to create some VMs off of it. So let's start with, I'm not going to go through it. One thing that you should know about using the capture feature is it is destructive on the virtual machine you're imaging. Whenever you sysprep a VM, it pretty much makes it not usable until you reprovision it. So just to show you what that looks like, all that's required to generalize a VM after you've already copied everything onto it is run the sysprep utility. And there's a few settings you need to know. The default system out of box experience is fine. You need to check generalize and shut down. Once you make those selections, click OK. Sysprep will go to work, taking away everything interesting out of your virtual machine, and then it'll shut it down. And once it's shut down, this little button in the portal will light up. So if I click on ISVM1 right now, you'll notice that down at the bottom, capture is disabled. However, if I wanted to capture a virtual machine, you have to wait till it's actually shut down, and then capture will show up. And if you click capture, you can then give it a machine the name of the image that you want to use for whatever you want to reuse this with, some kind of descriptive name. And you should make sure and tell it that it's been sysprep, so the Azure will know it's been generalized. So from there, I already have an image created, because it does take quite a while, long time to sysprep and generalize everything. I actually have two images created. The one we're going to use now is a WebFarm VM. So this is the same virtual machine that I used a little while ago. We customized with the Azure Store application. It has the application already copied over and should already be ready to go in a new farm. So what I want to do is show you how you can provision more virtual machines based off that image. So I'm going to just open up an existing script. You can see the only real difference from this one and the other script is the image. Instead of using the stock Windows Server 2008 or 2012 or SQL image, I'm just pointing to a user image. This is one that's already customized. It already has the Azure Store on it. And I'm basically going to create two more VMs for our farm. It's going to be ISVM 4 and ISVM 5. I'll go ahead and hit F5. And assuming I have no typos, it should go ahead and spin up two new virtual machines. Okay, and that will take a little while, but we are going to come back and I'm going to show you another couple of tricks you can use with these VMs here in a bit. Anyone, any questions about imaging? Is it all pretty clear? Good. What's that? Corey, would you like to answer the licensing question?
Sure.
It's actually a really good story. I'm just letting
Yep.
So the answer was, if you didn't hear, that was basically the hours you pay in your compute time cover your Windows OS license. Question? Go ahead. It doesn't work like snapshots. Like I said, it is destructive, so whenever you take an image of a virtual machine, that VM is pretty much gone. You have to reprovision to get it back. If you wanted to just make a snapshot of it, you wouldn't do that. What you would end up doing is, to make a really functional snapshot, is you'd shut the machine down, and in Storage Explorer, you can copy and paste to VHD. For the most part, even taking a running snapshot of it's pretty, I don't know how safe I'd say it. It works for me, but for fully consistent, I'd shut it down and copy. And doing snapshots in Windows Azure Storage is remarkably fast. Just copy on write, so you can literally copy terabytes and instantly. The Windows OSs that we support, all 64-bit. We don't support any 32-bit. And the only thing we officially support is Server 2008 R2 and above, so when Server 2012 ships. What do you want to see? It won't run on 64-bit OS at all? Yeah. That would be a problem. So SQL, right now, we don't have a separate licensing for SQL up in the cloud. We just have an eval edition. However, by GA, we will have a separate pricing. So whenever you spin up a SQL virtual machine, you'll have a separate, an increased cost to cover the licensing for SQL Server. So, but right now, we only have an eval. But that's expected by the time we release.
Service to a different version of the name,
Of the on-prem domain, right. Well, that's okay, though, because one of the things you can do, and we'll talk about it a little bit later, is Windows Azure Virtual Networks. So you could, what you would do in that case is you would actually establish the network connectivity between your on-prem domain and the public cloud first. When you provision that VM, it would actually find your existing domain controller and never miss a beat, assuming that's what you wanted to do. Otherwise, you would have to, if you wanted it totally disconnected, another option might be to migrate a domain controller from on-prem to the cloud first, and then it would be disconnected. You'd never want to put them back together, obviously, but that would be another option. But we do have site virtual networking now, so that's something that you can actually extend your entire enterprise AD out to the cloud. So, and I'll show you a demo of how you can do that later on. But so it's good. Our virtual machines actually did create. Usually, if you see a bunch of red here, you know that your demo failed. So deploying enterprise applications, AD. Hey, looky there. I forgot the timing. So Windows Azure Virtual Network, there's really three key uses. There may be four. The networking guy at the back can yell at me if I miss one. But the three key use cases for virtual network right now are if you have an application that requires persistent IP addresses, such as Active Directory, it really isn't good if your domain controller suddenly gets a different IP address because all your clients get lost and they can't log in. The second scenario is if you have hybrid connectivity needs. What hybrid connectivity really translates to in this case is you have a VM running up in the cloud that needs to access something somewhere in your data center. And we now provide functionality for bridging that divide. And the third scenario is if you need connectivity between your cloud services. And this comes in really handy in two key areas. One of them is, actually three. The first one is whenever you're deploying Active Directory in the cloud, because you can deploy AD in one cloud service and your clients in another. And the reason is because so you can configure these clients to talk to this one. And I'll show you how that works here in just a bit. And the other one is if you're using our existing PaaS, web, and worker roles today, you can actually have them join the same virtual network. And this kind of gives you the capability of using web and worker roles that can directly talk to applications running on VMs like SQL Server. Or they can actually talk to other web and worker roles and different cloud services too if they wanted to. So this is your AD question. The general idea is you can keep AD solely on-prem and not have AD in the cloud and all the replication goes over the site VPN tunnel. And depending on your application, that may be fine. Deploying something like SharePoint, probably not a good idea because SharePoint uses domain service accounts. It's very chatty, does lots of interactions, and the latency of going over the VPN tunnel may not be good enough to service the accounts. So in this scenario, I actually have AD up in the cloud, and in the demo, I actually do have a domain controller up in the cloud that has extended a existing force on-prem back in my office in Building 40 in Redmond. So this is the general architecture I was talking about, where you have two separate cloud service containers. The one on the left would be running Active Directory, and the one on the right is your AD clients. And the reason you need to do this is because you need to know the IP address of your domain controller before you can boot up the other machines. That way they know where to go. And you can actually set that DNS IP address whenever they boot up. So let's walk through and show you how you can deploy with AD. So just to show you the existing architecture, what I have. So right off the bat, we do have a virtual network set up. And what a virtual network basically, or what this configuration looks like, let me actually download it and I'll show you. Oops, wrong one. Where's my export? Oh, that one. Thank you. So this is the actual network configuration. If you're not a networking person, just close your eyes and ignore it. But it's not that hard. It's really a couple of things. I've deployed a DNS server configuration here that basically points to my on-premises Active Directory server. So whenever a machine boots up in the cloud, it automatically says, oh, you know, I can resolve addresses using this IP address. That means I can resolve domain names, internal domain names. So every machine that boots up in this VNet automatically has this specific DNS server provided to it. From there, I define the local network address space and the virtual private network gateway. So the address space, you see the 192.168, that are the machines on my local network that I'm going to allow communication with back to my my cloud data center. The 131.107 is the actual public IP address of a Cisco device I have back in Washington. And from there, you can see that I have some subnets defined. And those are the different subnets I'm going to deploy my application onto. Now, for most applications, unless you need hybrid connectivity, these can be extremely simple, one subnet. You know, if you just want two cloud services connect, it's really uncomplicated. Whenever you're doing hybrid AD to AD, it does require a little bit more complexity. But this is connected back. You can see the same settings. Here's my on-prem domain controller. So here is my actual domain controller. What's that? So you do not set up static IPs in the cloud. What you do is when any virtual machine that's provisioned in a VNet, the IP address is persistent forever, almost forever. It's like 2,148. So it's still set to DHCP, but you'll never get a different IP address. So whenever you do DC promo and it warns you, hey, this is DHCP, it says, yes, I know. Thank you. Do not set it to static IP, though. That's not a safe change to make. No, you can tell it. You can tell it. You know. Can do it. Just leave a DHCP and ignore the warning, because it's just a warning. It doesn't block you, right? You can actually walk through the portal and click a bunch of steps in a wizard. So, just XML is easier to jump into. But you can set that same XML configuration. You can set it from PowerShell as well, though, if you want to script everything. Okay, so I'll go ahead and RDP directly into my domain controller here. Okay, so you can see I have events web and SQL events. I have basically two machines in an OU that I've already provisioned for this demo. Now, one thing to note is I've done a bunch of different demos with this domain. So actually I have a bunch of different domain controllers scattered out over multiple subscriptions. The only one that's actually local is this one right here, or on-premise. That domain controller is actually sitting under my desk back at my office. The rest of those domain controllers are in different subscriptions and in the cloud. So if you really want to see something interesting, not that interesting, but you can actually use a remote desktop into the machine back on my on-premises, so it actually did come up. So someday it'll log in and you can see another desktop, but it's a long ways away. So the next step is, okay, so how do you provision new virtual machines, you know, to actually join AD? So you don't want, you know, if you need to provision 20 servers, you don't want to have to manually log in and join a domain each time. So what we can do is through the Windows Azure Service Management API actually supports provisioning AD at provision time. And we wrap that up in the PowerShell commandlet to give you a decent experience. So I'm going to do another demo, and this one is I'm configuring all the settings for Windows Azure or for a Windows Active Directory domain. So it's fabricam.com. I'm going to boot it up into an OU. And the reason you want to have a separate OU if you wanted to is because you could apply group policy specifically only to VMs running in Azure. So you can isolate them out. So I'm going to use my custom image called events image. It already has an intranet-like application on it. Okay, and then this one I'm going to provision two VMs. And you can see the add Azure provisioning config before just took two flags. It took Windows and a password. So we're doing a domain. It's a little bit more involved. You have to tell it which domain you want to join and the actual domain account that has access to Active Directory to allow this account to join. And finally, I'm just going to go ahead and create a new Azure virtual machine. And, oops, that is the wrong one. And then finally, the thing I need to set is the DNS IP address. That is the IP address of that that Cloud 8 domain controller. So once I set it, all the machines that boot up will automatically have domain DNS configured. They'll know where their domain is, and they can actually join up and be part of the Active Directory domain. Let's see. So assuming no typos here, I should have a couple of VMs provisioned into AD. Could be typos, though. And those will take a little while to actually provision. So a little bit about management. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but so a couple of things that you should just really consider whenever you're considering moving workloads out to the domain or to the cloud is virtual machines aren't significantly different than what you're used to managing now. The only difference is they're not in your data center. They're in our data center. So if you have an existing management monitoring solution, it should continue to work. The only real key here is making sure your management application can actually connect with your VMs. So the virtual private network is probably going to be the key for establishing that management connectivity. There are other capabilities in System Center, for instance. They have a gateway service. I'm not that well versed in it, but I know it does a lot of compression, and it can also work in a disjointed domain, so it can work in work group mode, that kind of thing. For any kind of Azure-specific automation, use the PowerShell commandlets. Right now, since we're obviously brand new, there's not a lot of automation tooling out there yet. Well, I take that back. We do have some cool partners, RightScale and those guys. But if you're not hooked up with RightScale and those guys, for just doing basic automation, add and remove disks, endpoints, that kind of stuff, PowerShell is probably going to be your best bet. Some of the basic capabilities you can do, you can provision, domain join, reboot, restart, delete, all that good stuff. Okay, so let me show you a real simple method of what you can do to kind of scale up or down and maybe save a little money in the process of how you can manage your Windows Azure virtual machines. So this has a dependency on my other VMs actually finishing creation. So let's see if they did. Okay, so 4 and 5 is what I was looking for. So this goes back to our first demo, the first web form demo. Oops. So if I look at the endpoint, I can see we have ISVM 1, 2, 4, and 5 in the load balancer. So I have 4 VMs running right now. What if you're a predictable traffic shop? You know when you're going to get your traffic, when you're not going to get your traffic. Maybe this is an application that works for your company, so you know you have 9 to 5, all your employees are there using it, and after 5 or 6-ish, no one's there. So why do you pay for the extra capacity? Through some simple scripting, you can actually shut most of this down after hours and add it back whenever you need it. That way you're not actually paying for anything you're not using. So a real simple example. I have 2 PowerShell scripts here. So the 2 commands I want to show are export and remove. So export Azure VM basically takes the name of the virtual machine in the service and dumps all the configuration for it to an XML file. Remove Azure VM actually just removes VM. It's not that creative. But what's interesting about this is we can take this PowerShell script and we can run it on a scheduled task, or we can run it on demand, however you want to do it. When you pair that with another script, which is add PowerShell script basically takes that XML file, all the settings that you saved, imports it back in. It basically rehydrates all the settings from the XML, and it re-adds the virtual machines. Oops. So if you pair that up with Task Scheduler, you can see how you can really just spin up or down all your entire application if you wanted to. So I have a, actually let me expand that out a little bit. So I have two scheduled tasks, a scheduled remove and a scheduled add. You can see it's pretty straightforward. It's just executing my remove script, and the other one just executes my add script. So what I can do is I can schedule that for 7 p.m. every day, make sure that everyone's gone, and the other one I can schedule at 5 a.m. to make sure, you know, it's all there before one starts. And if I wanted to run this, make sure this one's pretty susceptible to typos because I didn't have a chance to test it all the way. just imagine this was, you know, 7 o'clock at night. It runs a simple script. It dumps out all your configuration, and it starts removing your VMs. So now these VMs are completely gone. They're not being, you're not being billed for the actual compute hours. You're still being billed for the actual storage because we don't get rid of the underlying disks because we do want to put them back at 5 a.m. the next day. But once these are gone, you're no longer paying for them until 5 o'clock the next morning when the other scheduled task kicks in and they spin back up and your users use them. Any questions? Add, remove, anything? I had one on-premise and I had one in the cloud. Yep, exactly the same. The only difference is whenever it tells you you're crazy for using DHCP, you know that you're not crazy and you accept that. It is. Either of you guys know that much about Windows Azure AD? Okay. it's more of a federation service for your it's a way to, from what I understand, you'll have to actually go ask those guys for sure. But it's different because it allows you to replicate your AD specifically out for Office 365. But I think it could work in a lot of different cases where this one wouldn't. It's almost, I think it's one of those things where if your application could get away with using ADFS or Access Control Service, you could use that to authenticate against AD. But if your application had a requirement against using raw AD, like SharePoint does, and lots of other apps that just use Windows off, you'd probably be better to use an application like this. Right. So the question was, first question was, A, are we smart enough to automatically reconfigure the load balancer when we yank these machines out? Yes. the probe actually hits the machines every 15 seconds and adds them or removes them as it goes. And after the second question was, is there a way to dynamically scale the VMs? Right now, we don't have any type of auto-scaling service. These are persistent VMs, so it does take a lot more engineering than just your regular PaaS services. That's, you know, if you spin up 10 servers, they all have unique machine names, right? So you have to keep track of the state of each individual machine, and they don't have shared storage, that kind of stuff. So it is possible to script it and basically kind of roll your own. And I think, Corey, do you know if RightScale does anything like that yet? Any kind of a dynamic scaling with ours? They do. Okay, so our partners do it, I think, is inherently built into the platform. We don't do it yet, but some of the partners we announced recently do. But building your own that is possible, but it does take a little bit of work. So whenever you shut down a virtual machine, you're actually still charged for the compute time. Just because you have a reservation on physical hardware. So to actually avoid paying for it, you have to completely remove the configuration. But it's fairly straightforward. I think we're looking at making this scenario a lot easier in the future, though. Okay. And whenever that removes, I'll show you that the script did work and 4 and 5 are gone. Okay, so the final what I want to talk about is connecting cloud services. How many of you are using web and worker roles today, just cloud services in general? Okay. Are any of you ever tried to build them and been blocked by not having access to something that you needed a VM for? Okay. So the general idea behind this technology is it also is not just for VMs. You can connect cloud services to cloud service. But the general idea where this comes in extremely useful is whenever you're building new applications, you should, you know, steer as hard as you can towards building them in a PaaS-style environment. And the reason is you saw that whenever we built a simple web farm, the main thing we had to do is we had to go to each virtual machine, we had to configure it, we had to set firewall settings, all that good stuff. There's a lot of moving parts on larger applications. One of the biggest benefits of using web and worker roles is, at least at a minimum, the patching is taken care of. You can configure the firewall at configuration time. And your content is automatically synchronized. You know, we start off with a single image that has your entire application on it, and every time you add a new instance, you get it duplicated every time. There's no guessing that, you know, one VM might be out of sync with the other. Running web farms on VMs, you do have to worry about that. You have to, I mean, for instance, one of my demos broke horrendously about 4 days ago because I had a patch on one VM and I didn't have a patch on the other. And it took me a long time to figure out that why my cookie wasn't being read. You don't have that problem with PaaS. The problem you do have with PaaS is not everything works in that style of environment. For instance, the demo I showed earlier, the little tiny Azure store looks really simple. It would absolutely not work in this model because it has a dependency on full text search in SQL. And SQL Azure does not support that yet. So the right balance between the two is building your web applications using PaaS roles or building your worker role, whatever you want to do. And if you do have that dependency that, you know, something like full text search or DTC or Complus, whatever, that has that that networking requirement, or Active Directory, for instance, you can put them both in the same cloud service and enable direct connectivity between the two. And all that is just like how we join a VM to a VNet, you can join a PaaS service with a VNet as well. The only really downside to this is it is a little bit more complex to set up a VNet. It's not significantly harder, and it does put a little bit more burden on you because right now we don't have any type of internal name resolution. So whenever you put these two VMs in the same VNet or multiple VMs in a VNet, you don't have name resolution between the two unless you provide it yourself. Now you can still get outbound and everything else. It's just machine to machine. So let me walk through real quickly, show you how you can actually configure a PaaS service to be in a VNet. Let's see if my scheduled task ever finished. So if I refresh, okay, 4 and 5 are gone. And if I look at the load balancer, it's only ISVM 1 and 2. So yes, it is smart enough to remove them from the load balance set. Now the question is, how do you add them back? Same scheduled task, or same strategy, except this time it would be at 5 a.m. I want to run, and I got typos in that one, so no. Let's see what the error was. See if it's worth debugging. File to load to roll does not exist. Okay, so simple typos. Make sure you get your typos fixed first. And this will actually rehydrate those VMs. So now back to the other demo at hand, which is connecting cloud services. So I have an Events Manager application right now that I can open up. Actually, I think this one's just a web application right now. How many of you went to Mark Rosinovich's Windows Azure Virtual Machines and VNet talk? Good. So the majority of you won't have seen this cool demo. So let me show you the application real quick. The application is it's actually a real simple application. Running on AD, I'm already logged in. Just basically a real simple Events Manager application. Now, what's interesting about this is actually just a regular web app. It's running in IIS and wwroot. What I want to do is I want to convert it to a web role. That way I don't have to manage content synchronization or patching or any of that good stuff. And once it's converted, I can then add it to the same virtual network because I still have a dependency on SQL Server. So I can quickly add Windows Azure Cloud Source Project. This is a new feature in Visual Studio 2012 that just kind of converts my web application into a web role. From there, I would add the network configuration right here. It's just a copy and paste of some simple XML, but if I do Visual Studio, it'll crash. It's a bug. Sorry. So let me take this and package it. And what it'll do is it'll generate a CS package file and a CS CFG file. So the actual application and the configuration for the application. And I can take these, move them up somewhere where I can actually find them. And now I can open this up. As long as it's not in a project, Visual Studio won't crash. Okay, and what I've added, just real simple, it's the actual virtual network name, which is Hybrid VNet. It's the same one I showed earlier. The subnet I want it to belong to, and associate the actual role into that VNet. From there, it's a simple matter of creating a new cloud service. Click Deploy Cloud Service Package Now. Browsing to the package and browsing to the config. And if I click OK, it'll take about 10 to 15 minutes and it'll actually deploy. It'll be in the same VNet. Luckily, I have the same thing already booted. And I've actually went one step further. Instead of doing Windows Auth where my users get the big prompt, I've configured it to use the AD Forms provider. And this is authenticating against AD up in the domain. And you can see, down at the bottom, you can see the machine name. It's not a nice clean one like you'd get from a VM. It's the randomly generated one from your instances. Okay, so just to kind of wrap it up, we've talked about how you can create multiple virtual machines through the portal and how you can connect them into the same cloud service for direct network connectivity. We've talked about the general philosophies of migrating applications, whether you should build them directly in the cloud or uploading virtual machines using CS Upload. Talked a little bit about imaging virtual machines, deploying AD, and connecting cloud services. Does anyone have any more questions? Does this all kind of put things together? Go ahead. What's that? Failover clusters, we don't currently support clustering service yet, but that is on the roadmap very shortly. So for high availability for SQL, your best bet is going to be SQL mirroring. And for actual machine-to-machine, you don't need failover clustering like just web servers because we have another concept called availability sets. I don't know if you saw those earlier or not, but what they essentially do is whenever you group multiple machines like multiple web servers in an availability set, it physically puts them on separate hardware in the data center, on separate racks, so there's not a single point of failure. So as long, those only really apply for grouping the same kind of functionality, though. But clustering is coming soon. Well, SQL Azure is a separate service. You can access it from the same cloud service, but it's separate. But yeah, you can group. The one things you can't group, web and worker roles and virtual machines have to live in separate cloud services. But virtual machines and like web and worker roles, they can all grow and go and say cloud service. VMs, you know, SQL Server, IIS, Linux, whatever, they can all go in the same. The only thing you really can't group are the web and worker roles and VMs yet. I think that's something on the roadmap too. You know, just to kind of simplify that, let me show you a real quick and easy way. If you don't have any AD requirements or anything, if you really just have a web and worker role that wants to talk to a SQL Server, it's a lot simpler than it looks. Essentially, you would, through the portal, make a simple VNet. And you don't have to know a whole lot about subnetting. You just have to know the bare bones of it. So you can do, here we'll do 10. I'm more familiar with that. Basically, you want to give it a big bucket of IP addresses to allocate from. So this is, I don't remember how many thousands, a whole lot of thousands. And you want to give it a subnet. And from there, that's pretty much it. That's all you would need to actually connect, have a VNet that you could connect a cloud service into a VM. So whenever you go through and create a new VM, you can create a new virtual machine. And let me just pick one of the platform ones. Like if I wanted to create a SQL Server in that virtual network, VNet's not there. Hold on. Need to refresh. Hit F5 and do that again. So MySQL VM1. And there's our virtual network. So whenever that machine boots up, it'll be in that virtual network. All you need to do is the same little configuration setting in the PaaS and specify connected VNet. And whenever they both provision, they'd be on the same network. The only gotcha here is the SQL VM1. You won't be able to just type in SQL VM1 on your connection string. You will have to wait till SQL VM1 boots up, get the IP address of it, and then specify it from your PaaS role. That's the only little thing that will block someone. Any other questions? All right. You mean for like SSL? So you can install the SSL cert, just log in and install them through IIS Manager for authentication. You can actually specify those at provisioning too. You can deploy the certificates whenever you provision. Or after the fact, you can just RDP in and paste them in. So, gotcha. Not yet. When are we having console access, Corey? Soon. Because that would definitely come in handy sometimes. Yep. All right. Well, thank you very much.